parameters of the cosmological standard model. And then you have some data. But since this is a forecasting framework, rather than having a preferred realization of the data, like this could be an experiment that hasn't been done yet, you just specify a probability distribution that tells you how the data will depend on the model parameters. And then this is actually an approximation, but it usually works well in practice. There is this Fisher matrix that is given in this generality by this expression. That you interpret as the inverse covariance matrix on the model parameters given a typical realization of the data. So if you wanted to plot the ellipsoid allowed by the forecasted ellipsoid, then you could write down the Gaussian multivariate PDF with covariance matrix given by the inverse of this matrix and threshold it at whatever value you want to get the ellipsoid. And then you have all the information that you need to forecast different parameters under different assumptions. And we worked out a specific example, namely the case of a CMB temperature experiment, where the Fisher matrix was given by, I'll write down the more general version of the formula with a sky fraction covered and a noise power spectrum. And this is all you need to know if you want to compute, say, for some future post-Planck experiment, what kind of constraints you'll get on cosmological parameters of your choice. Then you can do it by more or less straightforward use of this formula. You'll just need to use a numerical package like CAMB or CLASS to compute the power spectra from cosmological parameters and get their numerical derivatives. Now, what I really wanted to tell you about is like a geometric interpretation of this matrix, which is sort of fun. So I want to write down three properties, and these are true in these are true in full generality. One is additivity. So if I have a data set D, which consists of two independent data sets, D1 and D2. One of them could be a CMB experiment, say, and the other could be a low redshift supernova experiment. But I'm going to assume that they constrain the same model parameters. It's important that they're independent. For example, two CMB experiments that measure different parts of the sky would be independent to a good approximation, but if their sky regions overlap, then they're not. The Fisher matrix of this joint experiment is the sum of the two Fisher matrices. The three properties that I write down, I'm not going to prove, although the proof of this one actually is kind of a one-liner, what independent means. Is that the probability of a particular pair D1 comma D2, conditional probability in a particular model is the product of the two probabilities. And it follows straightforwardly if you plug this into the definition of the Fisher matrix. The log turns the product into a sum, and then when you take the derivatives, you just get the two Fisher matrices. To draw a little cartoon of this property. There's sort of an algebra for ellipsoids that says that if I, let's consider two experiments that constrain different combinations of parameters but have a poorly constrained direction. That would, by the way, correspond to the case where the Fisher matrix has one small eigenvalue corresponding to the poorly constrained direction. then, you know, there's sort of an algebra for adding these ellipsoids together, which visually says that if I combine them, I get this. And what's not so visually obvious is that what this really corresponds to is adding the inverse covariance matrices together. That linear algebra operation, including the matrix inversions, just sort of automatically does this visual operation. So because of this property, the Fisher matrix is sometimes called the Fisher information matrix, or just the information matrix. Maybe you've heard that term before. Because we think of information as something that accumulates or is additive as independent data is analyzed. You might be interested in this formula, for example, if you're the director of a large funding agency. You might say, if you work at NASA headquarters and there are 10 proposed experiments that are going to be done in the next decade, and you're going to choose two of them, then you might tell each experiment, okay, send me your Fisher matrix in some basis, and then I'll add together all 10 choose two combinations and compute the ellipsoid and whatever parameter space I think is interesting, and try to judge which pair of experiments complement each other the best and produce the most interesting bottom line constraints. And that's what a large part of observational cosmology is doing, except for it's not like a centralized effort that happens at NASA HQ. It's more of a decentralized community effort that happens in archive white papers. Property number two is under change of variable, F transforms as a tensor. And what I mean by that is, imagine the following setup. I have one model with some parameters theta A. And another model that depends deterministically on that. So the theta primes are non-probabilistic functions of the thetas. Actually, I prefer to put the prime here. Let's do it this way. Theta will be a function of theta prime. I'm interested in some data which is a probabilistic function of the thetas. So this diagram would apply, for example, if would describe a reparameterization of the model space. Different forecasters may prefer to describe the same model space, for example, the six parameters standard cosmological model, just with different choice of variables. Like one forecaster might use omega matter as a parameter, and another forecaster might use omega matter h squared, and so on. I could also describe a submodel. So suppose that I've done a forecast in some large parameter space. This is a case where the number of theta primes would be less than the number of thetas. So if I've done a forecast in some large parameter space, and then I just want to restrict to some slice or submanifold in that space, then I would have this picture with fewer theta primes than thetas. Or a redundant parameterization. Where maybe I have some large model space that I'm interested in, but the data doesn't actually depend on every parameter in the model space. So I can factor the relation between the data and I could project the model down into some lower dimensional space, and then the data will only depend on that lower dimensional projection.
Is there is this restricted to linear transformations, or is this arbitrary transformations?
I want to consider the case where this is a nonlinear transformation. But remember that the Fisher matrix is kind of like a local thing that's just capturing some sort of local ellipsoidal approximation to the true distribution.
What's confusing is that it's a second derivative of something. So if that thing had been a scalar, why would the second derivative of a scalar, why would that be a tensor if you took two derivatives of a scalar?
It's not supposed to, you might think that the transformation law is more complicated. There is a term that turns out to be zero because of the fact that the integral of the, I'm actually not going to prove this because the proof is not super short. It would take a few blackboards. But let me just make the comment that there's a term that goes away because of the requirement that the conditional probability distribution is always normalized. And so if I put derivatives here, then some derivatives, so I always get zero. There's some non-obvious cancellation here.
Wait a minute, I don't understand that because that's probably the data given.
Oh, I'm sorry, I meant to write the integral over the data. Thanks.
I have a question back about property one that I forgot to ask. If there's a different set of parameters so you've got two data sets, which one of them depends on parameters A, B, C, and the second one depends on parameters A, B, C, D, even if you have the same model, which the first data set doesn't depend on parameter D, how do you deal with your different dimensionality Fisher matrices?
Oh, yeah, so maybe one way you might handle that situation is by drawing the following diagram. So suppose I have some data set that depends on parameters, let's say three parameters. And then I have another data set that depends on only two of those parameters. How would I combine those Fisher matrices? One way you might do it is by combining property one and property two. I could think about this diagram. And then if I have, the Fisher matrix for data set one, and I've computed the Fisher matrix for data set two in this model space, then I can pull it back to this model space by using the tensor transformation law, which I haven't written down yet. Let me write that. So the transformation law that I haven't written down is that Fisher matrix F here and F prime here, then the two Fisher matrices are related by if you like pure math language, you can call this the pullback, the rule for pulling back a Fisher matrix through an arrow that represents a function. This is the same transformation law as the metric in general relativity. And indeed, the Fisher matrix can be thought of as a metric on the model space. The Fisher matrix is some tensor that, and remember, it depended on the choice of fiducial model. So just like the metric in GR can be a function of the coordinates, the Fisher matrix is some symmetric tensor on the model space that transforms like a metric in GR. And indeed, it does define a notion of distance on the model space, namely distances correspond to observational distinguishability. So two points in the model space have Fisher distance one if a typical realization of the data would distinguish them at one sigma. So you could see these properties just for fun. If we go back to this expression for the CMB Fisher matrix, then you can, one thing that's true is that the Fisher matrix is a sum over L. And that has to happen because I could think of a C and B experiment as an independent experiment for each value of L. All the L's are statistically independent for a Gaussian field. And so this term that's being summed up can be interpreted as the Fisher information of a single L. I could, the 2L plus 1 is summing up all the M's. And then if I want to think about, if I imagine just restricting attention to a particular L and analyzing the single L as if it were a complete experiment, then I could think about factorizing that experiment this way. I'll project all of my model parameters down to one number CL, and then that is the only thing, the only number that determines my data. The one by one Fisher matrix for this parameter is actually something we computed last time. We did two calculations last time, the statistical error for a single CL and the statistical error for a set of cosmological parameters. And we computed this one by one Fisher matrix and just showed that it was 2L plus 1 over 2 times 1 over CL squared. So by property 2, the Fisher matrix on this model space, whatever it is, that n by n matrix has to be given by putting in two copies of the Jacobian, and then putting in the one by one Fisher matrix. So in complicated examples like the CMB Fisher matrix, these properties are just sort of lurking under the surface, explaining some of the algebraic features. I'm just mentioning that for fun. Of course, you could just calculate this directly, and as we did, and use the formula. And then finally, property 3. Describes what happens under marginalization. If you consider the following setup, model parameters and some data. And suppose that I decide that I'm not interested in some of these parameters. Like maybe they're just nuisance parameters that are specific to a particular data set, but they're not interesting cosmological parameters. In this diagram, I can use a diagram of this type to restrict to a submodel, which would correspond to fixing values of the nuisance parameters. But if I want to marginalize them, or integrate them out, then I'd have a situation where the arrow went the other way. So here, maybe the theta prime is some the theta primes are functions of the thetas, and this corresponds to a projection rather than a submodel. Then the rule is that the inverse Fisher matrix, transforms as a tensor. So the Fisher matrices here and here would be related by me write f prime inverse. I'm a little hardwired to use the GR notation, where when you invert the metric, you just write it as G with the upper indices instead of putting in the inverse value, instead of denoting the inverse. So there's also like a consistency with GR here. In general relativity, if I have a tensor with all lower indices, then I can pull it back to get another tensor by putting in the Jacobian. And if I have a tensor with all upper indices, like the inverse metric, then I can push it forward through, with the arrow going the other way by putting in factors of the Jacobian and getting another tensor. In fact, throughout this discussion of the Fisher matrix,
Should that be up under CD there, so you're summing over them and you get
no row? Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, thank you. In fact, in all of these formulas, I tried to be careful to put all the indices in the right place in the way that would be consistent with GR. Like when I write the Fisher matrix, I put the indices downstairs. Then when I write the inverse Fisher matrix, I put the indices upstairs. Collectively, these properties say that you should think of information or the constraining power of a forecasted data set as being a matrix quantity that transforms tensorially, like the metric in GR. And
where did marginalization come in there? I mean, why isn't 2-3 kind of a consequence of 2? What's the marginalization part of that?
So this would also be what would happen if you just had a bunch of... The easiest way to think about this is that imagine that I have a bunch of random samples that are distributed according to a multivariate Gaussian with covariance matrix F inverse. And then I just project those samples. Then the covariant down to a lower dimensional space. And I am making an approximation here where I ignore second derivatives of the transformation. It's the covariance matrix that transforms as a tensor. The covariance matrix of a linear projection applied to the data is just obtained by applying the two factors of the Jacobian to the covariance matrix of the original data.
What's confusing me is that if I buy that the F is a tensor, and you define something to be the inverse of it, how could that not be a tensor?
You're saying that this is sort of obvious.
Well, I don't see why where did the under marginalization play a role? Is this like logically independent of step two, or is it something which is just
I think it's
special case.
I think what's not independent about it is that the statement that one transforms as a tensor only if the other one does is that part is sort of circular, but the interpretation of the Fisher matrix is the inverse covariance is what's different.
Is it implicit in three that when you're not doing marginalization, F inverse doesn't transform as a tensor? What does it transform as if you're not marginalizing?
There's sort of two like building block operations.
Mm-hmm.
You could either restrict a model to a subspace, or you can marginalize by integrating out or discarding. You can project a subspace, and under those operations, you either invert or don't invert, and then transform.
So it always transforms as a tensor. It's just you don't do any transformations unless you're marginalizing that way, and you don't transform the inverse unless you're marginalizing.
Sorry, I don't quite see what you mean.
The first thing is that it's under marginalization, and normally when you have a property that's phrased like that, what this means is in this circumstance and not in other circumstances, the following is true. So if your data sets are independent, then you can add these things. If not, you can't necessarily. If this is saying under marginalization, this transforms as a set tensor. My question is, so if you're not marginalizing, does it not transform as a tensor?
Well, if
the subsequent question was, trying to figure out what you were trying to say, which is, I understood you say basically, when you're transforming your inverse, you're marginalizing. That's the time when you do this transformation.
That's right.
Okay. You just don't do that otherwise.
yeah, what this operation corresponds to is marginalizing.
Okay.
But this tensorial operation corresponds to its margin.
So was there an analog in geometry? I mean, they can easily see geometry project a metric onto a hypersurface, but what's this integrating over the thing? Is there some geometric interpretation of that?
Well, you might say that it's a good question. I haven't thought about that, so I don't have a good answer off the top of my head. There must be some situation in DR where you have a projection and you you raise the indices of the metric and push it forward.
Well, I mean, of course you can have orbits, I guess, and then you can have the metric, which is the transverse, like the metric that gives distances between orbits or something. But that's I'm not sure that's the same as integrating over this, but maybe it is.
There must be some geometric way of thinking about it. Like if you ask if I have some projection and I want to define a metric on the quotient space by saying that the length of this vector is like, or the squared length of this vector is the minimum of all possible, minimum squared length of all the vectors that project to it in that quotient space.
But it just naively, this minimum looks a little different from up here, as I understand it, you're integrating over something, right? I mean, you're integrating over the thing you marginalize over.
That's right, yeah.
That's the part that looks a little different, where here you're minimizing something.
Yeah, there is something non-obvious about this, which is the marginalization.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, this subject of Fisher matrices is actually has a reputation for being confusing. It's often presented as sort of a cookbook set of rules that you apply in different situations. There's a cookbook that tells you, what order to do a bunch of operations in, like taking matrix inverses. And what I recommend is that if you have to do this, that instead of trying to memorize the cookbook, you just figure out how to make your situation a special case of some of these rules. For example, here's an entry that's in the cookbook. Previously, I talked about I had a picture on the board where I was talking about an ellipsoid in two dimensions, and saying that there were two notions of statistical error on parameter one. You might choose to either fix parameter two to a fiducial value or let it marginalize. And those two statistical errors would correspond respectively to a matrix element of a diagonal element of the inverse Fisher matrix, or rather it's negative square root. Sorry, it's positive square root. The inverse square root of the diagonal element of the Fisher matrix. And you might wonder what the analog, how this works in more dimensions. So if I have, say, n parameters, and I'm interested in the statistical error on parameter one, with let's say k minus one parameters fixed, and n minus k parameters marginalized. Then the way that I could answer that question is I would draw this diagram. Let's think about it in two steps. One where I Let me do it in the other order. Let's have these guys be marginalized. These guys be fixed. So I could imagine that I start by fixing these parameters. So here I'm taking a submodel. And then I'll marginalize. Down to a single parameter. And then I just, if I have some Fisher matrix that's been computed in this space, I just chase it through this diagram. So to get from here to here, all I'm doing is, in the special case of property two, where the transformation that I'm pulling back through is just fixing the last n minus k parameters to their fiducial values, then that just corresponds to taking the Fisher matrix and dropping rows and columns, taking the n-dimensional Fisher matrix and dropping rows and columns to only consider its k by k upper left block. And then to do this marginalization step, I would invert that k by k matrix. And then I would push it forward. Here, the you know, pushing this forward through the Jacobian just corresponds to discarding all the rows and columns except for one and just keeping the upper left diagonal entry of the inverse Fisher matrix. So in this example, the difference between fixing and marginalizing variables amounts to the question of whether you drop the row or column from the Fisher matrix before or after doing the matrix inversion. There's a matrix inversion in the middle. The properties are more general and would apply to a situation where this submodel was, you know, just some arbitrary submanifold of this space, and the marginalization was some arbitrary projection.
I'm sorry, I think I might have missed something important here. Is there a difference between fixing a parameter later on and assuming from the beginning that it's, so like the speed of light we have fixed, but no one's going to include that in the Fisher matrix. That's just a fixed parameter of the universe. So mechanically, what is the distinction between assuming something is fixed and then not including it as a parameter from the beginning?
It would be like the difference between this and this. Whether if two parameters are correlated, then if one of them floats, it is a lot.
It just means like there's any number of parameters, or there's things that you assume, like the speed of light being one. There are just things in the universe. It's not one of the parameters in our model. We don't assume the theta. We don't have a theta for theta equals theta c is equal to one parameter. And so there's presumably a lot of parameters like that. We just don't include in the model because we take them for granted.
You might be distinguishing between the case where maybe something is known perfectly so that it's fixed, and its statistical error is very small.
Okay.
Right, in practice, there's not much of a difference between these two cases.
But what does it mean to fix something if that's not the case for fixing?
There is an intermediate case between marginalizing and fixing, where you take a prior on a parameter that could, in the limit of an infinitely wide prior, you're marginalizing, and in the limit of an infinitely narrow prior, you're fixing.
Can I get a for instance on fixing? What does that mean for you?
A situation where you might be interested in fixing a parameter is say you've already done a forecast where you've computed a Fisher matrix in the six parameter cosmological model plus some interesting new parameter like neutrino mass.
Mm-hmm.
Then you might be wondering, okay, I'm also interested in the parameter constraints that I get if the neutrino mass is assumed fixed to some default value, like the minimum value allowed by the oscillation experiment. So there would just be an example of what assumptions you're making about. You can't constrain everything at once, so you choose.
Just that you mentioned neutrino masses, how do we include priors? Say that in that
plot there, my parameters cannot go below zero, so I'm just focusing on the upper right quadrant.
Oh yeah, yeah, great question. Yeah, okay. So let's. So one thing that you can easily put in the Fischer formalism is a Gaussian prior on a parameter. So let's work out that case. Actually, let's say that's a great example. Oh yeah, what I mean is you don't need to assume a prior, but you can put one in if you're interested in some intermediate case between marginalization and fixing. So sort of by default, everything is marginalized. Let's imagine this setup. This is, I have some data, and suppose I know in advance that there's some poorly constrained parameter combination here, I want to put some reasonableness prior on, so it's not free in the forecast to float over an implausible range of values. And just an example that comes to mind is, this used to be the case in the CMB for tau, the CMB optical depth. Nowadays, it's pretty well constrained, but if we go back to like 2000, it was really unconstrained, and the forecasts would allow negative tau or implausibly large tau. We have a rough idea of when star formation happened and when electrons ionized in our universe.
Would negative tau even be physical? What would that mean?
What's that?
Would negative tau even be a physical?
Oh, no, of course not. as a simple case, imagine that we want to put a Gaussian prior on tau. So we have some central value, which is part of our choice of fiducial model. It's always necessary in the Fischer forecast. Plus some statistical error. Like, this might be a reasonable prior. Let me call this statistical error delta tau. Suppose that I've computed this Fischer matrix, and now I want to include the prior in the Fischer matrix. Work out some sort of forecast that accounts for this reasonableness prior on tau. Then what I could do is just interpret the prior as the result of another experiment. Imagine that I have a fake experiment, which is just a measurement of, all the experiment does is return one number, namely a statistic, a measurement of tau, an estimate of tau, with statistical error 0.1. So here's my CMB experiment. Here's my fake experiment, which is returning the prior. And I'll represent that experiment by the following diagram. I'll say, well, first I'll project this whole model space down to the parameter tau, which may or may not be one of the basis parameters, depending on how I decide to parameterize this. Then I'll just imagine an experiment where the data is just one number, an estimate of tau hat, with statistical error delta tau. The Fischer matrix for this one by one experiment would be 1 over delta tau squared. That's because the Fischer matrix is always the inverse covariance matrix, and the covariance is the square of the statistical error. If you want, you could prove that formally by writing down the Gaussian likelihood function here, and doing the usual Fischer matrix calculation. Then I want to pull back this one by one Fischer matrix through this arrow by putting in the Jacobian, so that the general rule would be that to put in a prior on a parameter, I just add the following rank one matrix to the Fischer matrix. I've written the rule in a covariant way, which applies whether or not tau is a basis parameter in the model space. And you could say, so it would apply to any a prior on any parameter, which can be an arbitrary function of the thetas. And you can easily see how to generalize this formula to, say, a multivariate prior with a covariance matrix or whatever generalization you're interested in. It's easier to memorize the geometric, to remember the geometric picture and then derive whatever. And this is one of the formulas that's in like the standard cookbook. It's easier just to remember the geometric picture than it is to memorize all the different, try to memorize a cookbook that covers every case.
If tau is one of the parameters in your original parameter set, then you've got d tau d tau 1, and so the old, it's going to be one diagonal element that's independent from the others.
Oh, exactly, yeah, yeah.
You'll just have one element, and that's just 1 over delta tau squared. You're adding to all of your diagonals, to your diagonal element there.
That's right, you just take one diagonal element and add 1 over delta tau squared.
Okay.
All right, so...
I know that this doesn't depend at all on that central value that you gave tau. So, like, when you were saying earlier is that you wanted to put a prior saying it shouldn't be negative or whatever, but all you've established is that this is the variance. This, I don't see where the value of tau comes into this at all. How does this prevent that from being negative?
So one thing, if you want to put in... The Fisher matrix formalism is always sort of a local thing that just depends on derivatives near the fiducial model, sort of like the metric in GR. And so it really can't account for, you know, a true reasonableness prior on tau would not be a Gaussian. A Gaussian would still allow, this Gaussian would still allow negative values at one sigma.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, the reasonableness prior that you'd want to use might look something like this.
There's no mean. I don't see where the mean of your Gaussian comes in.
It would be hidden when you compute the CMB-Fisher matrix. The CMB-Fisher matrix depends on the fiducial model, the fiducial CLs,
okay,
including fiducial value of tau. I decided to just talk about the Fisher matrix for a while, even though it's sort of a specific technical topic. Because at the beginning of the lectures, I said that I was going to pretend that the audience were consisted of people who were thinking about considering getting into observational cosmology, and the real point that I wanted to make is that the Fisher formalism is a piece of statistical machinery, and the word statistics maybe carries with it a certain like expectation of boringness. When I started getting into this, I kind of thought that I started off more interested in theory, and then I got pulled over into the observational side. And I sort of imagined it would be more boring, like if I was a theorist, that I would be doing some beautiful conceptual physics, and if I were analyzing data, I would be doing some boring statistics. If you get into it a little bit, it's actually pretty interesting. It's its own interesting little world. If you start with a really mundane-seeming question, like, how do I forecast the parameter sensitivity of a CMB experiment? And just follow that for a little while. Then you get into this sort of geometric picture, which looks a lot like, where you're thinking of information as a matrix and, you know, pulling it around through different geometric spaces, which is sort of like reminiscent of GR. And that's true for other types of statistical machinery, too, like Monte Carlo Markov chains are rich mathematical subject that you may have dealt with before if you are into data analysis that I won't have time to talk about. It's very interesting, and there's a lot of challenges. The software engineering, too, is also something that we have to deal with. I find like serious software engineering comes with its own challenges and is very interesting. As a way of just sort of giving you a sense for what life is like in the average day for like a blue-collar observational cosmologist, I thought the Fisher matrix would be a good choice of topic. Although it did take a little longer than I thought, and I'm not 100% sure that it was a good idea, but I think it was a good idea.
Probably longer because we have more questions, which means a good idea.
That's a good thing. Yeah, that's true. I really enjoyed all the questions. Yeah, thanks for asking so many questions. What I'm going to do in the last... I have 45 minutes left, and so what I thought I would do is the exact opposite, where instead of talking about something specific in technical detail, I'm just going to ramble for a while about hand waving about just some random things in observational cosmology that I think are interesting. I put together some big picture slides. And I'm just going to go through my slides. And, I have a lot of slides, and I probably won't get through all of them. I also think in the slides, I tend to like throw terminology around without defining it. I wasn't really trying to be systematic and pedagogical like I was previously. So let's say that this is more of a discussion than a lecture. And please feel free. It's totally fine if we get distracted on slide three, if you start asking questions, and we just go off on a tangent. I probably won't get to finish all of the slides. I'm just going to talk until the 45 minutes is up, or until I run out of slides, whichever comes first. So I want to start by, I called this observational cosmology past, present, and future, because I thought that would be a better name than 45-minute ramble. So it's really amazing to just like reflect on the progress that observational cosmology has made in the last few decades. Here are some quotes from really famous cosmologists. Here's Sandage in 1970, whose vision for the future of precision cosmology is that we would one day measure these two numbers, the expansion rate today and its derivative with respect to time. Well, these numbers are both, I mean, H is really well measured. Q is pretty well measured, I'll get to that. But then we measure, he wasn't imagining that we would be doing percent level cosmology with the CMB and measuring dark matter abundance to 1% and things like that. Here's Peebles. I don't have years for when the quotes were originally said. Most of these quotes were taken from a talk by Enrico Pyre, so thanks, Enrico. Here's Peebles back in the early days of the CMB, imagining that the CMB power spectrum was something that would never be measured. It was first measured in 1992 by the COBE satellite, and now is measured at sort of 0.1% overall accuracy. Saneyev thinking that the acoustic oscillation, that is to say the first peak in the CMB, would never be observed. That was observed collectively by a bunch of experiments in 2000. I'm not actually sure who should get credit for that. The acoustic peak is now used, the height of the first peak is now used as a calibrator for ground-based experiments. Finally, Mukhanov, what he's talking about here is the detection of deviation from scale invariance, NS being less than minus one. Thinking about this as like the total science fiction, and it was measured in 2006, and now is measured at many sigma. I think it's a really amazing statement that cosmology provides a real glimpse of physics beyond the standard model, the particle physics standard model. Just for fun, I did this little exercise where I tried to fit the acoustic peaks of the black curve, the CMB power spectrum, by a model with either no dark matter or no cosmological constant. So the observations are just grossly inconsistent with, detect dark matter or the cosmological constant at many sigmas. Physics, in some sense, physics beyond the standard model is sort of staring us in the face when we look at cosmological data. That's super interesting. I think it's important to say that cosmological observations, tend to have the property that you're just measuring a limited number of parameters. And if that's all you have, it's hard to narrow things down to a specific model. For example, to take the case of inflation. There we have, there's two numbers that are really well measured, the overall amplitude of the initial curvature fluctuations and the deviation from scale invariance. There's also an upper limit on gravity waves, which is very informative. And so collectively, those two and a half numbers disfavor, for example, m squared phi squared inflation, single field slow roll inflation, at a statistical significance of a few percent, which is really interesting, and they really narrow down parameter spaces.
I'm sorry, you use a statistical significance of something percent. You've said this a couple times with history. I don't know what that means.
That means that if m squared phi squared were the truth, then the probability of the observations appearing the probability of the observations arising as a statistical fluke is a few percent.
Okay.
So that's like a frequentist probability. So if I just say inflation without any qualifiers, like single field slow roll inflation, then I'm talking about a very general framework that could have any number of fields, a bunch of different possible interactions between them. Even if you say single field slow roll inflation, there's still a free function in the theory, the potential V of phi. And so if we just measure, and well, right now we have two numbers, and if we're lucky, we may get three or four. I think it's very unlikely that the cosmological observations on their own would narrow down the physics of the early universe to a specific model without some additional input from particle physics or from high energy theory. So here's the six parameter standard model again. And of course, what's really interesting is not shrinking error bars on these parameters, but looking for all the possible extensions that have been thought up. Here are some extensions of the standard model that I'm going to talk about in the subsequent slides. This was a historical exercise that I thought was fun. So forecasts often look really futuristic. They often look like science fiction. I thought it was fun to do this historical exercise where I went back to 1999 when Planck looked really futuristic, and compare the forecasts at the time to the statistical errors that Planck actually obtained. And you can see in some notation, which is not what I was using in the previous slides, this slide is actually from a previous talk, and I didn't necessarily make all the notation consistent. You could see that Planck actually did a little bit better than the forecasts from 16 years before would have predicted. It is, even though forecasts may seem futuristic, I don't think it's unrealistically optimistic to just sort of take Fisher matrix forecasts at face value. The thing that the forecasts don't necessarily capture is the amount of time that things take. So a forecast that Planck did not meet is the forecast for when Planck would happen. The original launch date, I don't know, but it was closer to 1999 than it was to 2015. So I think the lesson is that forecasts come true, but it's harder than you think, and it takes longer than you expect. That's a fair statement.
So did that extra time give them the ability to do better than the forecast for the accuracy decision?
No, I don't think so. I think it just takes a really long time to build stuff and test. The actual specs, the actual design was basically the same. All right, so one thing that's useful to know is that in this six-parameter space, the CMB really dominates the constraints. So here's some numbers from the Planck paper that compare parameter constraints in the standard model from the CMB alone to parameter constraints from the CMB plus a bunch of other types of cosmological data. And the numbers really aren't that different from each other. So that's why talks about observational cosmology do tend to focus on the CMB, despite the variety of data that's out there. This is not necessarily true in extensions of the standard model. It is possible to add parameters which lead to parameter degeneracies in CMB data, but not in when other types of data are added. I'll talk about some examples of that in a bit. You never really see examples where here are some statistical errors from the CMB alone without including any external data. And you never really see it happen the other way, where a lot of cosmological parameters are constrained at once from non-CMB data without putting in the CMB or some sort of CMB prior.
Sorry. So, the combined data, so they are all without tension to each other, right? Otherwise you wouldn't combine them.
Oh, that's an interesting question, and I don't have a slide on it, but there's this really interesting question about whether there's tension in between the CMB and low redshift experiments, and the way it's usually phrased is as a tension in H-naught, the expansion rate today. You'll get different answers from different cosmologists, but my feeling is that, so I don't have a slide on this, but I'll just ramble for a little bit. My feeling is that something there's something real and interesting there, which is not a statistical fluke. If you take the value of H naught that is inferred from the CMB, Now that is not a direct measurement. The CMB, you know, doesn't directly measure the expansion rate of the universe today. It's just a fit that assumes the six-parameter model. Then you do get a value. If I compare that to low redshift supernova measurements, those values now differ at more than 3 sigma, and that significance has been creeping up over time. You know, there have been some interesting developments along the way, like, you know, periods when it didn't look like when it didn't look very statistically significant, and then it came back. But without going over the whole history, and you might also worry about, you know, things like cherry picking the most discrepant data sets. There are, you know, we decided to look at H-naught from the CMB and compare it to supernovae. But we could have chosen any pair of data sets. There are, I think, 5 different independent ways to constrain H-naught in cosmology. Or we could have chosen a parameter other than H-naught. So you might worry about, like, the look elsewhere effect associated with all those choices. More than 3 sigma is, it's so hard to get that as a statistical fluke. It's less than 0.1% unlikely. My feeling is that it is, unlikely to be a statistical fluke, and there's something real going on there. Now, what a lot of people tend to assume is that somebody's underestimating their statistical errors, especially, or their systematic errors, especially for supernovae, where systematic errors are comparable to statistical errors. If you underestimate systematic errors by, say, a factor of 2, then you could easily turn that 3.3 sigma into, you know, 2.5 sigma, which wouldn't be very significant when the look elsewhere effect is accounted for. But the supernova community has been really careful. So I don't think that there's, at least when I read their papers, that, you know, they're doing things like blind analysis. They're they seem, if anything, rather conservative in how they assign systematic errors. I think that it's, one should just keep an open mind. It's not clear what's going on. Of course, the most exciting possibility is that, if these were 2 direct measurements of the expansion rate, then one of them would, and they were intention, then one of them would have to be wrong. But since the CMB doesn't really measure the expansion rate, it's just inferring the expansion rate from a 6-parameter model fit, then the most exciting possibility is that there's some new physics, that if we knew what new parameter to put in, that everything would come into agreement. So far, no one's really been able to come up with, like, a convincing story like that that would bring everything into convincing consistency. And I think it's hard when you're in this, like, 3 sigma regime to draw any conclusions, to draw, you know, definite conclusions. But if this discrepancy keeps going up over time, like if it goes up to 5 sigma or something, then it could be something really interesting could be going on. So I don't have the answer. It's, like, just an unsolved problem that a lot of people are thinking about. We say that... all of our cosmological observations are consistent with the 6-parameter model. But actually, that's not true if you take all the data at face value, or at least I think it's not clear whether it's true. That's a really interesting, important puzzle to remember.
So the ones that are intention, then they are not included in the combined values, right? That was what I was going for. So about this measurement, and out of these 6 parameters, either there should be no tensions or they should not be combined to a central value, right?
Oh yeah, right. So yeah, you might on this column, the direct H-naught measurements are being put in. These numbers are taken from the Planck paper, and what Planck does is they split the H-naught data up into subsets, and then they throw away the subset that's most in tension in order to bring them into agreement. I personally don't think that's a very well-motivated thing to do, but that's what's what's happening in this call. Because at least in this 6-parameter space, the external data sets are actually not adding much information, it's not probably much of a practical issue. But in other parameter spaces, it really matters. Yes?
Relatedly, what do you think about the sigma 8 tension?
It's really closely related. There's some, like, global direction in parameters. There's some combination of parameters mm-hmm. where the data sets are in tension that includes H-naught and sigma 8. It is basically the same problem.
When you say there's six parameters, you know, no one ever talks about the spatial curvature, and why is that not counted as a parameter?
Oh yeah, I'm just classifying it as a extension of the model. You could, I suppose it's just a matter of definition whether you put it in and say that its fiducial value is zero. But I like to think of it as an extension.
But whereas the other things are kind of extensions in a concrete sense that you're adding physics to the basic picture, the curvature of space was just one of the options you had. Just from, if you wrote down your FRW metric and you put in isometry, or you put in, you know, isotropy and homogeneity, and that was one of your parameters. So it seems kind of funny that it's in the same bin as all the exotic physics.
I don't know. Would you say it's less exotic? To me, it has it's just a subjective question. But to me, it has like the same level of exoticness as, say, gravity waves, which are, something that could be in the metric or could not be. Likewise, the spatial curvature is something that could be in the metric or it might not be. You don't have to change, you don't have to...
Is it biased by acceptance of deflation or something? Tends to predict that, these simple models tend to predict it's pretty nearly flat.
That's true. If you're like an inflation true believer, then maybe you think that gravity waves are more likely than curvature.
So, I think you're arguing that there's eight parameters, not seven. I'm just thinking from the point of view of particle physics. If you think if I compare the time-dependent dark energy, that's kind of a very radical new physics-y thing. Whereas spatial curvature and gravitation waves is an initial condition issue. Sorry, right? It sounds like that's just stuff that was in my vanilla model, and I made a choice about.
I agree that if I had to bet on which was more likely, W not equal to minus one or R not equal to zero, I would say R not equal to zero is way more, or curvature is more likely. I think it's subjective what things you decide.
But I guess we're in sociologically, the only reason I'm pressing the point is that we sell the cosmology as saying that we've got the six parameter model, but what we really had was more parameters, and some of them we just set to zero. And that's less of a convincing sell at some level.
If you wanted to, if you wanted to get into like the sort of arbitrariness in this counting, you might say that tau is not really a free parameter, since in principle it's determined from the other parameters by astrophysics. We just don't know how to calculate it. Another thing that's true is that we could think about adding a parameter to the list, namely the CMB temperature today, which is we don't include that as a parameter because it. It's really like a value of a clock. There's one more parameter that might make sense to add, which is just the time at which we observe the universe. Not everyone actually counts the number as six.
But the time isn't the time it's the time determined. But those numbers up there, does that determine both H naught and the time? I guess if you assume it's flat, then it determines H naught, doesn't it? Because you've got the cosmological constant. That sets a scale, and then the other things tell you what fraction of energy density. So if you assume it's flat, you've got H naught, I guess.
This list is one parameter short. You could either add the CMB temperature today, or you could add H naught as a parameter.
Oh, the CMB. Yeah, okay, the CMB is.
Isn't, at least at some level, the energy density of dark energy degenerate with the curvature? Because basically, that's how that's measured, basically.
They do similar things. They affect the expansion history at late times. They would eventually, spatial curvature would eventually dominate over matter-dominated expansion. Right. But the details are different. Spatial curvature behaves as a to the minus two.
Seeing degenerate sets of the six that had basically curvature and didn't have your dark energy density, depending on who's writing that down the six.
We can tell the difference.
The W map, it's got basically a curvature parameter in there instead of the other.
So it is true that W map on its own, before Planck, the CMB on its own could not distinguish between curvature and dark energy. I have a slide on that. In that extension of the standard model, or Clif standard model, there would be the allowed region would be like a long degenerate region that would allow either zero curvature and a cosmological constant, of order 0.7, or a zero cosmological constant and a large curvature. That's not true, but even in the WMAP era, non-CMB datasets could break that degeneracy, and in the Planck era, we can break it from the CMB alone. I have a slide on that. Okay. Oh, it's my next slide. So the CMB temperature can constrain every parameter in the six-parameter model, in particular the cosmological constant lambda, even though lambda is negligible when the CMB is formed. And the reason for that is that lambda affects the subsequent expansion history, and therefore the distance at which we observe the CMB. And changing that distance would leave all the high redshift physics unchanged, but it would change the correspondence between physical distances on the last scattering surface and angles. And so in this plot, I've shown how if you vary lambda, leaving all the high redshift physical observables fixed, then all the peaks shift over fractionally in L. So that's great. Go CMB. But there's a problem, which is that if I now add another late universe parameter to the parameter space, meaning a parameter which, like lambda, leaves the high redshift physics the same but just affects the expansion history, then I can't tell the difference. So a parameter space with n late universe parameters would contain an n minus one-fold degeneracy. So here's an example. I got a little carried away writing this talk, and I did real camp runs. So these are real runs, not a cartoon, where I started with this blue fiducial model, and I could either change the cosmological constant, or I could leave the cosmological constant at its fiducial value and add curvature. And these curves lie like exactly on top of each other. And so before Planck, this was the situation. The CMB contained this nearly exact degeneracy. And even WMAP in like 2010 was consistent with a universe with zero cosmological constant and large curvature. Now, with Planck, something interesting happened, and that degeneracy was broken. Because Planck measures the CMB power spectrum out to high enough L that CMB lensing becomes an important effect. So CMB lensing, nowadays in 2018, no CMB talk would be complete without talking about CMB lensing. So what CMB lensing does is it perturbs geodesics, so that if I look back to the surface of last scattering in a lensed universe, that geodesic is deflected. And I think that I see the temperature in this direction, but I really see it at this point on the last scattering surface. This picture, of course, is super exaggerated, so that it looks like lensing is a one radian effect, whereas the actual effect is more like a few arc minutes. So here's a simulated realization of the unlensed CMB, just to give you a sense for how important this is. And here's the lensed CMB for comparison. So it's a small effect, and it might look visually like it's not very important. But if you look at the power spectrum, especially on small scales, it is hard. Oh, yeah, I should have increased the line widths here. It's hard to see these lines in the projector. You may not be able to see them. If you compare the power spectra in these zoomed regions, so if you look very closely, maybe you can see the red line here, then you can see that the lens and unlens CMB power spectra do significantly differ. What lensing is doing is it's smoothing out the peaks, and at high L, it's also systematically adding power. And that turns out to break the distance degeneracy. The distance degeneracy means that there is a direction that I can move in parameter space, where I change, say, the cosmological constant and curvature at the same time in such a way that they cancel in the total distance to last scattering. But if I move in that direction in parameter space, the unlensed CMB will remain the same. But the growth of perturbations at late times, the amount of gravitational collapse, is different because dark energy and cosmological constant and spatial curvature, differ in the details of the expansion history, and they'll produce different amounts of gravitational lensing. So this turns out to break the distance degeneracy reasonably well in the CMB. I'll show a plot in a little bit.
So, is the origin of those CMB lensing is that coming from structure or only from an FRW?
It's coming from perturbations in the late universe that have grown gravitationally.
So So you have to include nonlinear evolution of dark matter, I suppose, to get this, is that right?
It turns out that for CMB lensing, approximating this matter distribution by its lowest order linear prediction is not a bad approximation. For sure, you know, in principle, this matter distribution is, you know, has there are collapsed structures that are very nonlinear. The best way to break degeneracies like this is to use non-CMB data. Something that's particularly powerful and is going to be super interesting in the next 5 or 10 years are baryon acoustic oscillation measurements in galaxy surveys. So just to introduce the language that the galaxy astronomers use, let me think of this acoustic peak scale that is changing here as I vary lambda and I vary this distance as a standard ruler. So that means that there's some physical scale that's fixed on the last scattering surface, some physical wave number. And if I think of that as being like a little ruler, then by observing the apparent size, the angle that the ruler spans on the sky, I can infer the distance. The same thing happens in a galaxy survey. A galaxy survey measures the number density of galaxies throughout the universe. And you can measure redshifts, at least if your galaxy survey is spectroscopic. You have a spectrum for each galaxy, and you see the spectral lines. You can measure the redshift very accurately. And you can make a map like this, with redshift playing the role of the radial coordinate. You have a 3D field, the galaxy number density field. And you can take its power spectrum, or Fourier transform the power spectrum, and get the correlation function. Treat it like other fields in cosmology. The galaxy astronomers like to use the correlation function, zeta, whereas CMB cosmologists like to use the power spectrum, P of K, for a 3D field. They're just Fourier transforms of each other, but when you look at this plot, just keep in mind that it's the Fourier transform of the power spectrum. It has this bump, which is similar to the peaks in the CMB power spectrum and arises from the same physics. So I can think of that as a standard ruler whose the location of that statistical feature in the correlation function as a feature with a fixed physical scale. And if I observe it to have a particular angular size on the sky, then I can infer the distance back to that redshift and measure the expansion history. If you really think this through, you'll see that there are two standard rulers. If I have a standard ruler with a known physical size, and I observe it transverse, I observe the transverse angle that it spans, then I've measured the distance d back to the redshift of the ruler. And I can also observe the ruler radially. So if I observe the endpoints of the ruler in redshift, then what you constrain is the Hubble expansion rate, since that gives the conversion between the Hubble expansion rate at the redshift z, because that's what would give the conversion between redshifts and distances. Unlike the CMB, where we always measure angles, here there are two rulers. And even more powerfully, we can bin the galaxies up by redshift and measure these two functions as functions of source redshift. Unlike the CMB, where the only source redshift is redshift 1100. This is a really powerful observation. It's really difficult to... One qualitative difference between the CMB and galaxies is that the CMB is determined by really well-understood, complicated, but really well-understood linear physics. And there's no problem in principle. It's a lot of work. But writing software to compute the CMB power spectrum, you know, almost as precisely as you want. But the detailed physics that produces this pattern of galaxies is very complicated and nonlinear and includes a certain amount of astrophysical uncertainty. And so that makes it difficult to use, for example, the all of the information in the shape of this correlation function for cosmology. The location of this peak, the distance at which galaxies correlate is relatively robust to those details. So most of the information in this correlation function is the actual details of the shape, most of the error bars. Currently, it gets thrown away, and one number is kept at least 90% of the time, which is just the location of the peak. So BIO measurements are super powerful for expansion history. So here's an example from the, I took this from the Planck parameter papers. This plot is a little crowded and super straightforward to read, but this is showing the same parameter space that I was talking about before, the extension of the six parameter model where you include spatial curvature. The curvature here is 1 minus omega lambda minus omega matter, so that this dashed line corresponds to a flat universe with zero curvature. This shows the power of CMB lensing and BIOs to break the distance degeneracy in the CMB. The black ellipses show the parameter constraints from the CMB without using gravitational lensing. And you can see that there's a big degeneracy here, the distance degeneracy that we were talking about before. And if you include lensing, you get this blue ellipse, which is still kind of long, but it's a lot better than the black ellipses. And this little red ellipse includes BIO information, which is from galaxies, which is super powerful for breaking the degeneracy and zeroes in pretty precisely on a universe with large lambda, but zero curvature, or consistent with zero spatial curvature. At this point in my ramble, I've been talking about expansion history and dark energy a little bit. Here are the current constraints. The cosmological constant and spatial curvature can be distinguished from each other to high significance, and curvature is super consistent with being zero. The other parameter that is often mentioned is the dark energy equation of state W. You can think of that as either the pressure of the dark energy, the FRW pressure divided by the density, or you can think of it as parameterizing the energy density of the dark energy as a to the minus 3 times 1 plus W. So W equals minus 1 corresponds to a time independent dark energy density, in other words, a cosmological constant. So W is constrained with a 1 sigma error of 0.08. But thanks to this factor of 3, that means if we ask what the dark energy density is at redshift 1, we're interested in how well we know that the cosmological constant is really constant, then the 1 sigma error is, fractional error is 24%. That's only the 1 sigma error. So that's actually kind of a large uncertainty. And I would say that we at the moment, our observations are consistent with the cosmological constant truly being a constant function of time. But that's not a statement we can make with super high statistical significance. Improving this number is a huge program for observational cosmology. And this constraint will improve by an order of magnitude or so from the next generation or two of BIO experiments. Those experiments will get really powerful. However, as far as I know, there's no natural threshold for dark energy. This is sort of annoying. There's no reason we should expect, if the cosmological constant is not really constant, it to show up at 1% or 5%. As far as I know, this is just sort of a fishing expedition where we have the opportunity to shrink an error bar. So we'll do it and see what happens. We can't say that there's a natural threshold coming up or anything. I'm only going to get about a third of the way through my slides. I'll just talk for another 5 minutes. It's 10:25. I didn't talk much about... I didn't talk yet about CMB polarization. There is a decomposition of... The CMB is linearly polarized. There is a decomposition of linear polarization into so-called E and B modes, which is almost the same thing as the gradient and curl modes of a vector field. Linear polarization is a traceless symmetric tensor, and so the details work differently. It would take maybe 15 minutes or so to explain them, but you can see visually here what's going on. What's interesting about B modes is that there is a theorem that says that if the cosmological fluctuations arise from scalar sources, like the adiabatic curvature without indices, and if linear perturbation theory is a good approximation, then which it mostly is for the CMB, then no B modes are generated. There's a symmetry argument that I can't state precisely since I didn't define this decomposition precisely, but it essentially follows by parity invariance. If I have a, if linear perturbation theory, the way the argument works is something like this. If linear perturbation theory is a good approximation, then I can think about the effect of initial conditions on the CMB, one Fourier mode at a time. And if I consider one Fourier wave number k, then if the initial conditions are symmetric under rotations around that wave number and parity reflections through that that leave that wave number fixed, then there's a symmetry argument that says that the only polarization patterns on the sky that are consistent with that set of symmetries is an E mode. Rephrasing this theorem, B modes can only arise from either if there were primordial gravity waves, if you have some non-scalar sources with indices in the initial conditions, like a gravity wave, or second order effects, the largest of which by far is gravitational lensing of the CMB. Gravitational lensing of the CMB is formally a second order effect because it's the response of one linear perturbation in the foreground, lensing the geodesic, and then the geodesic seeing a perturbation in the background. Some models of inflation do predict this background of gravity waves, and the standard way of quoting their amplitude is to quote the ratio between the power spectrum of the gravity waves and the power spectrum of the scalar adiabatic curvature in the initial conditions. That has an upper limit of around 0.1. So we know that in the initial conditions of the universe, the total power in the gravity wave part of the metric is 10% of the power in the scalar mode, or less. Unfortunately, I'm at 10:30, so I guess I just have to stop here. That's too bad. I was having fun with these slides. Well, look at all these fun slides. Oh, what a tragedy. All right.
We'll have all the slides online.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, I guess that's the end of the lectures. Are there, I guess
we have time for some quick questions. Someone wants to ask a question.